Chapter 25. The lads weren't the only ones who needed to be reminded not to shoot, as we watched the Cristang truck slowly lurch by a couple days later. Smythe, Giraud, I, and a few others lay belly down behind rocks on the reverse slope of a hill as the Cristang truck drove back down the river valley below us. It was tempting, almost too tempting a target. With our Cristang rifles, we could easily have knocked treads off the truck, then picked off the Cristang one by one. If the Cristang and the truck were the only ones on the planet, that would have been a viable plan. In reality, we had to watch silently as the truck passed our position. As an extra precaution, none of us had brought weapons to our observation post. I wasn't worried about someone losing discipline and firing off a shot. I was worried about a weapon discharging accidentally. Yeah, it was a small risk. It was also a risk we didn't need to take. The Cristang in their truck didn't know we were there, couldn't see us, were not a threat to us. Their truck reminded me of the U.S. Army's N-977 heavy truck, except instead of eight wheels, the Cristang truck had four flexible tires like our sunken RV. The cab had a flat front with large windows. Through my Z-phone camera, I could clearly see the two Cristang in the cab. Behind the cab was a canvas sort of cover. Two more Cristang were sitting with their legs hanging over the tailgate, looking very pissed off. When we first saw the truck rolling along beside the river, it was moving fairly quickly over flat ground. Now, right below us, the river made a series of lazy bends, and the truck had to slow down to splash across streams. Skippy told us that truck didn't have swim pontoons. It couldn't float like the RV had. It was just a truck with fancy treads. On a planet crisscrossed with rivers, swollen with snow and glacial melt, a vehicle that couldn't cross a significant body of water was severely limited in where it could go. That explained why the Cristang had chosen to go out to an Elder crash site they had already explored. There weren't many places they could go, now that we had destroyed their aircraft and RV. The truck was driving back over its own muddy tracks, returning to the base the same way it had come out. In several places along the river, there was only one place to go without driving through water deep enough to submerge it completely. It went through a stream, and I found myself holding my breath. The truck was submerged almost up to its hood, and the two Cristang in the back were now standing up, keeping their feet out of the icy water. Even from where we were hiding, I could faintly hear the truck's motors whining. One of the left treads spun freely, then caught, and the truck waddled up the other side of the stream. The truck stopped, the left door opened, and a Cristang got out to inspect the front left tread. Then the other Cristang in the front got out, and the two of them talked while pointing at the tread. One of the laborers in the back poked his head around the side, and the first Cristang pulled out a pistol and gestured for the laborer to get back in the truck. The two in the front kicked the tread, and clods of mud fell out. After peering at the tread a minute and discussing something, the two leaders got back in the cab and the truck lurched back into motion. After a while, watching the truck drive on became dull. When it became clear, the Cristang had no idea we were there and only wanted to get back to their base. My attention wandered away from the truck to Captain Smythe. I wondered how many times and how many godforsaken places Smythe had done this exact same thing, lain in wait, observing an enemy, deciding when and how to strike. Within 10 minutes, the truck went out of sight around a bend in the river.
Skippy said there are six of them in the truck, Smythe said quietly. The most we could have taken out at one time were three. No go. It wouldn't have worked anyway.
And we couldn't have walked all the way to where they camped overnight in time to hit them when they were sleeping, I added.
We stick with the original plan. Let that truck drive back to the base. Give it 20 minutes to get well ahead of us, and we'll go down there and follow it. We should be within striking distance of their base tonight.
The big unknown in my plan to assault the scavenger's base was whether we could get close enough to launch a surprise attack, or whether the Cristang would see us coming far away and prepare the defenses. If the Cristang had made even a minimal effort at external site security, such as scattering a few cameras around the base perimeter, they could have ruined all our plans. A couple cheap cameras were a simple precaution that could have forced us to fight a pitched battle against Cristang with equivalent technology, with them in prepared positions. While we marched toward the base, Smythe and I discussed how to approach the base from multiple directions, using one group as a decoy, before the main assault team swept in from another direction. Neither of us liked the odds of that plan succeeding.
To my surprise and delight, back when I was dreaming up the overall plan against the scavengers, Skippy confirmed the scavengers had made zero effort at protecting their base from external threats. The leader's only concern was security inside their base. The only threat they foresaw was from their own forced laborers. The base inside the fence was riddled with cameras and other sensors, and doors were locked with codes that only three of the leaders had access to. On an uninhabited planet, a planet without land animals larger than a tiny insect, the leaders must have figured cameras outside the base were not necessary. They were wrong. After the scavengers saw from Skippy's faked satellite data that they weren't alone on the planet, that other Kristang had been there, had even shot down their air power, you would think the scavenger leaders would have done something, taken some steps to prevent hostile forces from sneaking up on their base. They did absolutely nothing. After seeing the faked satellite of the other Kristang having flown up into orbit and then jumping away, the scavenger leaders once again thought they were safe. Stupid civilians. That was great news for us. The day before we were scheduled to reach the base, I asked Skippy to confirm there were no cameras, motion detectors, or other sensors outside the base. He replied that as far as he could tell, and he was tapping into all their communications, there were no sensors of any kind outside the fence. As far as he could tell. That was the problem. While we could plan for the best, we had to account for the worst. It was a judgment call, and as the commander, I had to make it. If there were in fact no cameras or sensors outside the fence line, we could wait until daylight to attack, because my plan relied on the Kristang being awake. If there were sensors of any kind outside the fence line, then it would be best for us to approach the base and launch the attack at night to catch the Kristang as off guard as possible. If I assumed there were no sensors and I was wrong, our daylight assault could get difficult very quickly. But if I assumed there were sensors and we launched a night assault instead of sticking to my original plan, I would needlessly be putting human lives at risk. What I decided on was a compromise. We approached the base from two directions at night. One team of six people came in from the east as a decoy force. Once they were within half a kilometer, the rest of us, including an alpha team of two men in armor suits, ran toward the base from the west. If we were detected, the base would sound an alarm and Skippy would tell us right away. At that point, we were committed to hit the base as fast and hard as we could. There was no going back. Nothing to go back to. If our night approach was not detected and we got to the ridge 200 meters west of the base, we would hide behind the ridge until daylight and implement my original plan. To my original plan, I added a silent prayer before we crossed the start line. We each took with us weapons, water, a sludge, and first aid kits. Our two actual qualified doctors remained at the start line with the rest of our equipment, a kilometer from the base, under a bluff. Part of my prayer was that we wouldn't need the doctors. The weather was cold, but clear that night. A local TV weatherman, Skippy, said skies would remain mostly clear until the following afternoon. I took that as a good omen. Unfortunately, I mentioned my thought of omens out loud while Skippy was listening, and was subjected to a scathing lecture about ignorant, superstitious monkeys. It's a good thing he didn't know I was also wearing my lucky underwear. Yeah, lucky underwear is a real thing. Skippy's intel was right. No alarm was sounded. We got to our initial hold position 200 meters from the base, spread out to give good coverage, and we lay prone on the ground behind a ridge that was maybe 5 meters tall at its highest point, just enough to give us cover. We set up Z-phones sticking just above the ridge as cameras and monitored the view from our own Z-phones. We waited throughout the night silently, communicating by hand signals. As dawn approached, lights came on inside the scavenger base, and Skippy told us the Kristang were engaged in mundane tasks such as eating breakfast, showering, and arguing with each other. In 2 hours, two of the leaders planned to go out to the Elder crash site with six laborers to resume digging. Once they were outside the base, there was a strong chance they would see us, so I launched Phase 3 of the plan. Phases 1 and 2 of my plan relied merely on the Kristang's strong desire to possess an Elder power tap and Skippy's ability to control the data feed through their satellites. Phases 1 and 2 did not require the Kristang to do anything specifically Kristang-like in nature. Any species would want an Elder power tap. Perhaps the fact that the scavengers were especially eager to grab it as soon as possible before the starship they were expecting could steal it and jump away was a particularly Kristang characteristic, but no species would leave such a valuable object laying exposed on the ground for long. Of course, they would send an aircraft to pick it up, and of course, after the aircraft crashed, they would send their remaining air power to get the power tap. Humans would have flown a dropship to the crash site out of concern for any survivors of the crash, or at least to investigate the cause of the crash. The Kristang likely wouldn't have cared about any of that. Probably they'd consider such actions a sign of weakness. No matter what their motivations, the Kristang had fallen for our traps, phases 1 and 2, that wiped out their air power advantage and reduced the Kristang we potentially had to fight by 11. I'd been hoping one or both of the air sorties the scavenger sent out would contain at least one powered armor suit to reduce the number of those we had to face. Sending an armored suit seemed to me to be a blindingly obvious part of any plan to pick up a priceless Elder artifact. Someone in armor could more quickly and easily reach the site in the rough terrain of the Canyonlands. Someone in armor could more easily, and more important, safely, bring the artifact back to the aircraft. Crossing freezing cold, fast-running streams, walking over broken rocks and smooth, wet, slippery muds, sliding through mud, would all be safer in a powered armor suit that had gyroscopes and computer-controlled stabilizers. Unfortunately, although the Kristang would probably have agreed with me about the wisdom and practicality of sending armor to pick up the Elder power tap, they had a uniquely Kristang factor to consider. They couldn't trust their forced labor with powered armor. Even one of the 6 high-ranking Kristang who had armor wouldn't risk being away from the base surrounded by forced labor. In the close confines of an aircraft or hemmed in by canyon walls, a Kristang in armor would lose much of the advantage of wearing armor and be vulnerable to a concentrated, planned attack. The result, which sucked for us humans, was no armor was in either of the aircraft. That meant the scavengers at their base had 4 functional sets of armor that we would have to deal with. Too many Kristang, 4 of whom would have armor against our human spec ops team, and we had only 2 sets of Kristang armor with us. Phase 3 of my plan was to deal with the scavengers' numerical and armor advantage, and the advantage they had of being in defensive positions. I had thought long and hard about how we could defeat the scavengers. That's a nice way of saying we needed to kill them, all of them. Because I couldn't think of any way for us not to kill them, given their advantages of numbers, technology, and being on the defensive, I decided the only solution was for us to outsource the job. We would get the Kristang to kill each other. That's why my plan relied on them being awake and up before we launched Phase 3. I contacted Skippy. "Hey, Skippy, you there?" "Of course. How's your back feeling, Joe?" "Better," I admitted, "now that my pack is lighter." My pack was lighter because I was no longer carrying a section of powered armor and because I'd eaten most of the food we started out with. Dehydrated sludges didn't weigh much, even in 14% higher gravity. The armored suits were now assembled and ready for use in combat. My hope, if my plan worked, was that we wouldn't need our Alpha team with 2 sets of armor for a while yet. "You ready for Phase 3? "More than ready. I'm eager to see if this works. It will be an interesting experiment in Kristang's social dynamics." "Uh-huh. Sure thing," I agreed. "Activate Phase 3 whenever you can." "Done. If you're right, we'll know pretty quickly." "Yep, that's what I hope. Let me know as soon as anything changes over there." Phase 3 was simple. It didn't involve any decoys, any manipulation of satellite data, any shooting down aircraft, or any elaborate cover-ups of human involvement. The essence of Phase 3 was that the truth shall set you free. Only in this case, the truth was being given to the Kristang forced laborers, and the you really being set free was the human assault force. Free, hopefully, from having to engage in a protracted firefight with the Kristang. The truth part of Phase 3 was, in fact, truth. What Skippy did was grant the forced laborers access to secure communications of the 6 Kristang leaders. Not 100% exactly what the leaders said to each other. Skippy spiced things up a bit to get the laborers' attention quickly. Skippy made the breakdown in communications security seem like a system glitch, and it took the laborers a while to notice, even longer to take advantage of their surprise access. The data they had access to was, in essence, all true. The food supply at the base was dwindling, and the 6 leaders planned to either kill or abandon their forced labor on Newark when the starship arrived. While maybe the laborers suspected that was going to happen anyway, getting smacked in the face with it certainly made them hop and mad. Anger is a useless emotion, until it can be channeled into action, and that was where the other data Skippy gave them access to came into play. He gave them access to the base physical security systems, like the doors that kept the laborers locked in when they weren't working, and the doors in the entire base, including the high security area where the six leaders lived, and most especially, the locks to the armory building, where the leaders kept almost all the weapons, and three of the four work in armored suits. Sentient beings, whether they are human, Ruha, Gristang, or any other species in the Milky Way galaxy, tend to avoid risk and tend to hesitate when presented with new information, particularly when that new information makes them question things they previously believed. Fortunately, most groups of sentient beings have one or two members who do not hesitate, who take decisive action, and those dynamic individuals usually bring the group with them. In the case of the laborers, there were three Gristang who didn't hesitate, who boldly and angrily took action. These three Gristang were younger sons, who were not technically prisoners or slaves. They were younger sons of impoverished sub-clan families, who had volunteered to join the scavenger expedition in a desperate attempt to improve the fortunes of their families back home. These three felt especially betrayed that their leaders planned to abandon them on Newark with the criminals and slaves who made up most of the workforce. The first thing the three did was verify the access codes truly could open the door that kept them trapped in their de facto prison. When that door opened with a metallic click, they moved out immediately. The laborers knew their leaders were watching them, knew the leaders had seen the laborers become agitated and angrily arguing amongst themselves, and knew the leaders would be notified as soon as the door was unlocked without the leaders' authorization. So as soon as that door opened, the three bold laborers moved quickly, and the others followed. The others followed because they knew their leaders would punish all the laborers equally for attempted rebellion, knew they faced death whether they actively participated in the mutiny or not. It was all or nothing, and such clarity is a great motivator. The entire group of laborers raced through the camp toward the armory while the six leaders hesitated, stunned, for crucial seconds. When the six leaders finally faced their shock and new reality and roused themselves to action, the first thing they did was argue amongst each other. The primary leader, the one who had funded the scavenger expedition, knew that only he and two others had codes to unlock the armory door, yet he could see on the security system display that the laborers were confidently racing toward the armory building and had already unlocked the gate to the electric fence that surrounded the armory. The primary leader instantly drew only one conclusion from what he was seeing. One of the other two Gristang with the codes had given them to the laborers in an attempt to take over the base and steal the precious Elder artifacts for himself. Accordingly, the primary leader took out of its holster the pistol he constantly kept on his belt and shot the other two. Now there were four leaders left, and one armor suit available in the primary leader's cabin. The other three functioning sets of armor were in the armory building. After killing two of his fellows, the primary leader, with his pistol pointed at the three others, backed into his personal cabin and locked himself in. He came out 4 minutes later in an armor suit and led his three fellows toward the armory. On the video screen, the leaders could see the laborers had reached the armory and had already unlocked the outer door. A minute later, as the leaders reached the fence that surrounded the armory, shots rang out from both sides. It was a chaotic, bloody mess, a pure firefight without any planning, tactics, or coordination. The primary leader charged directly toward the back door of the armory building. He must have known that if the laborers got the other suits on, it was game over. The other three leaders poured fire into the open doorway of the armory, cutting down laborers as they came out, firing blindly. The laborers' numbers began to tell as one of the leaders went down and the other two pulled back around the corner of a building for cover. Three times, Smythe reminded the team not to fire, regardless how tempting the target was, and to keep down and out of sight. Our Alpha team, the two men in suits, were particularly itching to get into the fight. Keeping our heads down was a good idea, not only so the Gristang didn't see us, but also because there were explosive-tipped rounds flying thick through the air all around the base. The leaders had a few heavier weapons, and explosions sent shrapnel everywhere. The laborers responded with improvised explosives they'd taken from the armory. When the fighting ended, there were only three Gristang left alive on the planet. Two leaders, wearing armor and hunkered down in their own building, likely still in shock and trying to decide what to do, one laborer, holed up in the armory building, holed up with the precious stash of Elder artifacts and a whole lot of explosives. explosives he threatened to detonate if the leaders didn't take off their armor suits, come into the open, negotiate how to split the artifacts, and assure the laborer he would be getting safely off the planet. According to Skippy, he actually did have a chance to survive. Though Krystang society would not be happy about him participating in a violent mutiny, they would respect his courage, and more importantly, his success. The Krystang rewarded success in combat. I knew that from very personal experience. Unfortunately for him, we knew from Skippy listening in on the two leaders' conversations that they planned to betray and kill the laborer. We needed to deal with the three remaining Krystang. To put it simply, we needed to kill them quickly, and with minimal risk to ourselves. By ourselves, I mean the Spec Ops troops, not me. I didn't even have a weapon. What I had carried across the surface of Newark was ammo and part of an armor suit. Yes, I had experience in combat. I'd even killed Krystang. With the Spec Ops teams, I could only get in their way. Each team of four or six had trained extensively with each other, knew their tactics, knew each other, knew their roles, knew what every other member of the team would do in a situation. Each team had trained with other teams, and each soldier had cross-trained with other teams. Rangers had taken a place on the Chinese team, Chinese with the SAS, French paratroopers with the Indian counterparts. Although I had participated in some of the training aboard and outside the Dutchman, I wasn't qualified to go into combat with them. "What do you think?" I asked Smythe. "It would help if we could draw those two leaders out of cover," Smythe mused. "Going to be a hell of a firefight if we have to go in there after them. Two armored suits against two armored suits, and they're bigger, faster, and stronger than humans. They've been using armor probably since they were little. We still don't have enough real experience for me to be confident of our chances in this one. That bugger with the explosives is the real problem. That's where we could use our suits. Go in high speed and hit him before he can react. We can't do that if we need our suits to engage those two leaders. Somehow we need to make that laborer disarm those explosives, or distract him even a short time, make him hesitate." He looked up at me. "You have another magic trick up your sleeve, sir?" "I wish I did," I said, shaking my head slowly. Magic is what we needed right then. The Spec Ops people were committed and brave, willing to go in and accomplish the mission regardless of the cost to themselves. Willing to go in if I ordered them to. An order I didn't want to give. It wouldn't be right for me to send them into a straight, brutal firefight simply because their commander couldn't think of a better tactical solution to the problem. Yet, we'd come this far. We couldn't simply give up now. A magic trick would be a great thing to have right then. All magic is based on deception. I sucked in a sharp breath. "Captain Smythe, I have an idea. Skippy, you listening?" "I'm here," Skippy acknowledged. With an attentive audience, I explained my plan. Smythe grinned appreciatively. "Sir, I think Skippy is right. You are an evil genius." I had to laugh at that, despite the seriousness of the situation. "This will work?" The Spec Ops people were the experts on what they could accomplish and not. "Oh, yes. We'll handle it from here, sir," Smythe said, and turned to sketch out an attack plan in the mud. Phase 3 Bravo, that I dreamed up on the spot, began by Skippy transmitting over the radio. The message was supposedly from the Krystang who had shot down the Luzzard and the dropship and stolen the Elder Power Tap. Pretending to be one of those Krystang from the Red Stone Clan, Skippy made a plea to the laborer with the explosives. He explained that the Red Stone Clan's ship had never truly jumped away. It had been hiding behind a stealth field in orbit the whole time. The Red Stone Clan had given the security access codes to the laborers, and if the one remaining Krystang laborer deactivated the explosives and joined the Red Stone, he could split the reward. Our two men in armored suits stepped over the ridge into clear view and began running toward the storehouse where the laborer was holed up with the Elder AI, the precious comm node, and a pile of explosives. 3 Bravo worked, because the three remaining Krystang heard Krystang talking to them and saw two unfamiliar Krystang armored suits pop up and run toward the base. The scavengers were alone on Newark, as far as they knew. They believed our story about the Red Stone Clan instantly, because that was the only possible explanation, based on what the scavengers knew. They had no reason to think the two Krystang armored suits running toward the base contained anyone other than Krystang from the Red Stone Clan. To think anything else right then would be absurd. Our deception worked as intended. The two leaders in armor screeched angrily over the radio and stepped out from behind cover to race toward the armory, intending to get there before the two Redstone clan in armor suits could. From where they were, the two leaders couldn't get a clear shot at our two armored warriors. Several buildings were between the two pairs of combatants, and our men weaved as they ran, using low spots in the hill slope to keep out of plain sight. The Spec Ops teams had practiced this broken field running in suits many times. Skippy's opinion was that because of the size gap between humans and Kristang and the different running gaits of the two species, a human wearing armor would look strange to a Kristang, and any Kristang would notice something wrong fairly quickly. With our two men running down the hill slope, leaping from cover to cover, they weren't clearly visible long enough for the Kristang to tell those armored suits didn't contain Kristang. Or so we hoped. The two scavenger leaders were not making any attempt to keep to cover, racing at the full, amazing speed their suits could manage. They were fast, almost too fast. Our entire assault team, except the alpha team of two men in armor and one rifleman waiting for a clear shot at the laborer, had our Kristang rifles sighted in on the scavenger leaders, and even with advanced knowledge of how fast beings in suits could run and the super technology of Kristang adaptive gun sights, most of our first volley of shots missed. Enough shots did hit the two scavenger leaders that they went down quickly, stumbling and falling, skidding across the ground. Now alert to the danger, they separated and attempted to get behind cover. They were too late. Massed fire, with 8 to 10 rifles concentrating on each set of armor, knocked them back down again, and our explosive-tipped, armor-penetrating rounds began to bite through the tough armor.
"Cease fire! Cease fire!" Skippy shouted over the private channel. "Stop shooting! Those two are dead! You're wasting ammo!"
Before I had to say anything, we all stopped shooting at the two now-inert Kristang leaders. Our two men in armor didn't hesitate. They kept running toward the armory building. This was the moment of maximum danger. If that lizard in the armory decided he had nothing to lose and detonated the explosives, we could lose our two men in suits, the comm node, and the AI. I was about to order the two men in suits to halt so we could try talking to the remaining Kristang, but the sharp crack of a rifle interrupted me. The sniper we had assigned to cover the armory had not lost focus for a second, despite the gunfire ringing out all around him. The massed fire had attracted the attention of the laborer in the armory. Curiosity, or maybe the fear of not knowing what is going on, overcame his better judgment and he popped his head up for a quick look. Not quick enough. A sniper from the Chinese team drilled him once in the head with an explosive-tipped round, and that was the end of it. Fortunately, the laborer hadn't rigged up any kind of dead man switch on the explosives because nothing further happened.
"You certain you got him?" I asked the sniper.
"Yes, sir," he said, and transmitted his gun scope camera image to my Z-phone. There was no question about it. The lizard's head had exploded like... Well, I'll spare you the unpleasant details. What mattered was that lizard, it wasn't going to be a problem for anyone ever again. "Alpha team," I ordered the two men in suits. "Approach with caution. Everyone else hold position." We waited while the alpha team and their armor carefully leapfrogged toward the armory. This was a situation where I wish we had the full suite of Kristang infantry fighting gear, especially recon drones. We could have launched a drone into the armory without risking anyone's life to get us all the intel we needed. As it was, with only two armored suits and no recon gear, we made do with what we had. One, then both of the alpha team disappeared inside the large door of the armory. Then one of them came outside and waved to me.
"All clear, sir. No booby traps. He would have had to manually set off the explosives. Looks like he was mostly bluffing."
"Skippy," I inquired, "what do you think?"
"I concur. All is clear. None of the Kristang are alive."
"Damn," I breathed a sigh of relief. "We did it. We actually did it." Smythe saved his weapon, stood up, and crisply saluted me.
"Sir, we destroyed their air power and neutralized all of them without a single shot being fired in our direction. This is the most successful operation I've ever been involved in. That was a hell of a plan, sir."
"So far, Captain. So far." We still needed to hide from the Kristang ship that would arrive before the Dutchman was ready, then later get off the planet safely. "Let's secure Skippy's magic radio and the AI, and then I'll think about celebrating somewhat."